It looks like we're getting to a stable point, so I think we can get started if you're ready, Barbara.
I am.
All right. So good afternoon, everyone. I want to thank everybody for attending the first of four webinars. These are really aimed at helping us get a conversation going with each other about how we plan to phase in to our reopening plans. Preparing for those fall semester. You know, these four webinars, they're not meant to be specific guidance from SUNY system to the campuses. This is really just an opportunity for us to discuss what we all learned together and maybe start to inform you of some best practices that are happening in New York State and across the country. And today, our colleague Barbara Boyle has joined us. Barbara is the Director of Environmental Health and Safety at System Admin. And Barbara is also a member of the Physical Preparedness Working Group within SUNY. So Barbara's done a lot of research on libraries and reopening, and she's been plugged in and taking notes at a lot of the Realm project updates that are taking place. So she generously agreed to step in today and just share her wit and wisdom, what she's gleaned from a lot of the reopening plans and also what she's heard nationally and across New York State. So Shannon's going to record, and as he said, we're going to monitor the chat. But at this time, I just want to turn it over to our colleague, Barbara.
Okay, great. So keep your fingers crossed. This worked 2 minutes ago. Okay, am I sharing my screen now?
You're good. Yep.
Okay, let me just get to my speaker notes, and we're set. So thank you all very much for joining.
Barbara, your speaker notes were showing, but it looks like it just tucked under, so you should be good.
Tucked under, okay, good. Okay. This is what you have when you have two screens. and actually, it just tells me what's coming next. So libraries in the days of COVID. So I started to look into libraries a little while ago to help the physical plant people who are trying to make the facility part, the physical plant structure of the campuses ready for this post-COVID or coming back into the campuses. So I am a certified industrial hygienist and a certified safety professional, and I work here at SUNY System Administration in the Office for Capital Facilities. In that capacity, I support campus programs in occupational health and safety. So that's things from dermatitis of a custodian to a laboratory exposure to chemicals to a trench collapse. And everything sort of in between. So those are like OSHA regulations. I also support campuses for environmental compliance, so EPA and DEC type regulations, fire and life safety code concerns, and also emergency planning. So during COVID, I've been involved in a lot of the discussions on how to move forward, both first, how to close, and then second, how to move forward. I've learned a lot during this time. I'm excited to do this group, though, because my mother-in-law is a retired academic librarian. I think her degree is from the University of Buffalo. Most of her degrees are. But she worked as a librarian, usually at night, at Canisius College and Niagara University. She is now safe in Southern California in her house that she goes to the grocery store once a week and is doing well. So if what we say provides some value, maybe I could get letters of support. I did marry her baby 33 years ago, so any positive responses would be good. The negative responses, I'll just take, okay? So, disclaimers right off the front. COVID is caused by a novel coronavirus, and we're going to learn new things every day. We don't have a rock-solid history for COVID, but we can apply general principles of science to how we're addressing the COVID problem. I am not providing SUNY guidance or a SUNY mandate or anything along those lines. I've done research with the CDC, New York State Department of Health publications, and then an assortment of professional organizations, both in health and safety, my wheelhouse, and also for some libraries. So I don't have a crystal ball, and I don't think that Auntie M is likely to be checking in with a vaccine. And I have tried clicking my heels together. COVID does not go away. So I'm strong in occupational safety and public health. I am not a library manager, so some of the recommendations I make may not work for your library, and that's fine. We do have an overlap here, though, and that's the place I want to be in so that we can have some discussion. Perhaps I can share some of my understanding of the world of COVID as you can apply them to your libraries. So let's just get this right out. If you're not in strict isolation, if you go to the library, if you go to the supermarket, if you take your dog for a walk, the risk of COVID in the United States today is not zero. Okay. Nothing we can do about that. But we can significantly reduce the risk by taking a look at our activities and taking prudent steps. So as I see it, the situation is that we really need to understand libraries, colleges, whatever, that we can't be all things to all people ever. And certainly we can't be all things to all people in the days of COVID. We're going to have to restrict some of our activities, some of the things that we would really like to see ourselves doing may not be possible in this novel semester with the novel virus and the novel challenges. We need to remain as flexible as possible because what we know today might change a little bit tomorrow, or great plans that we put in place today may not seem so great in a week. And so we really need to be able to pivot to address the situation. One of the things that people in my profession tend to talk about when they talk about protection is the Swiss cheese model of protection. And this is really great for COVID. So basically, it takes a look generally, a general hazard, in this case, the novel coronavirus, and it only can cause problems if that little arrow can get through layers of cheese. And layers of cheese are the different protective steps we take. So the only way you can get from the germs, the virus, to disease is that that arrow can get through the pack of cheese. So we use Swiss cheese as an example, and it can easily go through the holes in one piece of Swiss cheese. But if we provide different types of protection and different types of approaches to this, we're adding different layers of Swiss cheese, and it makes it harder for the arrow to get through the cheese to cause a problem. So throughout this conversation, I'm keeping this in the back of my mind. No one thing is going to be a perfect thing. However, we can layer protection and then hopefully find a place that's reasonable and keep us relatively safe. One of the things that I don't know if you're already on campus or on your way to campus is that a lot of campus planning has been going on. I am most familiar with the planning that's been going on with the facilities people. Remember, your library is just part of a bigger campus, so they have been meeting for months now, talking about all sorts of issues from traffic flows to HVAC systems to what sort of disinfectants can be used, what sort of new technology is out there. They've been working very strong trying to prepare the campus, and so the library staff really needs to start talking to the facility staff, if that hasn't already occurred, I hope it has, to work into the campus plan. As you know, each campus had to submit a reopening plan, and there may be parts of that that will restrict your limits. Each campus is going about things a little bit differently, so your choices may be limited by what's in your campus plan. So I just want to take some couple of seconds to go over how do you catch it, the coronavirus. So this poor guy from the CDC let his picture be taken years and years ago, and now he's all over the place. Hopefully he has like a social media account and is making some money off of it. So basically we know that droplet transmission is really important. So this is viruses and like little bundles that have saliva, mucus, other proteins and whatnot around it. They're fairly large. They're more than 10 microns, with a micron is one millionth of a meter. And so they're fairly heavy and they mostly fall out fairly quickly. So that's how we get to the stay 6 feet away from people, because most of the time in 6 feet, most of the particles will have fallen by then. There was a lot of discussion early on about fomite transmission, which is a fancy term for contact, surface contact, which means that I sneeze onto a countertop, and 5 minutes later you come by and touch it, and then a couple of minutes later you touch your face or your eyes. That is a way to get the virus, which is why we're going to talk a little bit about housekeeping and custodial activities. It's probably not nearly as important as droplet transmission. When we get to the next one, aerosol transmission, this is sort of new. It's been in the news a lot. What that means is that while people are just talking potentially, or when they're coughing or sneezing or whatever, you're releasing very small particles, much smaller than the 10 microns, and they remain airborne for some period of time and capable of causing disease. We don't know how much of COVID is transmitted that way. It is not the primary way. However, it does explain some weird things that people have documented. COVID does not appear to be, though, like a real aerosol transmission disease. So, for example, measles is mostly spread through aerosols. And what that translates to in real life is if someone has measles and goes to your doctor's office and is examined, and 2 hours later your doctor lets you go into the same exam room, you might pick up the measles. Because it stays in the air for that long. That does not appear to be the case of COVID, but we still want to talk a little bit about HVAC systems and getting lots of fresh air into spaces. At this point, we still don't know what an infectious dose is. Does one little virus particle potentially give you an infection, or do you need a fair number of them? And that's a function of diseases, and the coronaviruses are all over the place. So as a family, we don't quite know where this one falls in yet. Our major tools when you get back on campus are testing and contact tracing, which I won't talk about here, and that is identifying people who are sick and getting them out of the workplace or the school place, getting them home, and figuring out who they may have infected. The next one is face covers, and we can see lots of documentation, although there are political arguments, but basically, if you look at the literature, when communities implement face covering, their infection rates go down. And then also social distancing. Since most of this is droplets and they fall out within 6 feet, if you can stay 6 feet away from other people, you're much less likely to catch COVID. These last two are called NPIs, or non-pharmaceutical interventions. And they're with a bigger portfolio that includes hand cleaning, surface cleaning, cough etiquette, screening people, the ways that we can prevent the disease from spreading. The CDC has a whole bunch of information that you can go and take and print out and post all over the library or post all over your house, whatever it is you'd like to do, on all sorts of COVID-related topics. So this one is just follow everyday health habits. Just little reminders about 6 feet and washing your hands or using hand sanitizers. And just for the record, washing your hands with plain old soap and water for at least 20 seconds is the best. It's the ideal thing to do. Use hand sanitizer if the soap and water is not available, but plain old soap and water is the best way to get the coronavirus, if it happens to be on your hands, off. You don't need to use any sort of special soap or antibacterial soap, plain old soap and water. CDC has even started to go to special groups, so this is college, back to college tips. And again, these are available. They're in the public domain. You can use them however you'd like. Watch your distance, wash your hands, wear a face cover. They also have a bunch of materials that talk about going back into public after we've all been out of public for a while. So part of that document is visiting a library. It's meant more for community libraries, but a lot is similar. When we talk about reducing the risk, we often talk about a hierarchy of controls. And I just want to quickly sort of talk about this in terms of COVID. So the hierarchy of controls says that there are certain things that you can do, like elimination and substitution of hazards, that are really effective in protecting workers or protecting the general public. These are ones that often require thinking about things before you do them, and upfront initial costs. So elimination means you completely remove the hazard. So if I have a factory and I'm making furniture and people keep getting hurt on the old bandsaw, maybe I just eliminate that bandsaw. Substitution is replacing the hazard. So that is if I have my furniture factory and I'm using toluene as a, or methylene chloride as a furniture stripper, maybe there's a better chemical that I can substitute. Then you get into engineering controls, which somehow or another tries to keep the hazard away from the person. Again, a significant expense at times, but it is really effective. And then you get into administrative controls and PPE. So administrative controls are changing how someone works, changing rules, behaviors, and whatnot. And PPE is personal protective equipment. Those last two depend on people doing what is best for them at all times and not taking shortcuts because it's Friday afternoon and the sun's nice and the beach is waiting. So those are things that are less effective overall, but sometimes you can get them into place really fast while you're waiting for the others. So this is a general approach to hazard control. So for COVID, it's a little bit different. Elimination and substitution aren't really options because we have the COVID. So it's more like we have a building on fire. You can stay home, you can work remotely, you can try to avoid other people, but we can't really do too much past that. At this point, the building's on fire. We have to hope that we can get the fire out. Engineering controls become more important when we talk to COVID. So this may include barriers, partitions, sneeze guards, and the like at customer points of service. So that's just like what we have at most of our grocery stores. Did someone want to say something? Okay. So we can put those up, and that will provide us with some protection when we have to meet with the general public. HVAC adjustments, that's your ventilation system, those may become important. We can take a look at our activities and our equipment and see where we can be hands-free or no touch. We can make sure that we're not doing things like sharing pens, that we're not taking cards and handing them back and forth at the point of control. Maybe if the card just needs to be scanned, the person can hold it and scan it. So it's taking a look at actions like that. And we can also look at what sort of disinfectants that we're going to be using. So I wanted to just talk a little bit about HVAC because the governor came out a while ago and said malls can't open unless they have HEPA filtration. And the problem is that most buildings can't have this ultra, ultra fine HEPA filtration on their air conditioning or heating systems. The system is just not meant to work like that. Most large buildings, what happens is you take in outdoor air and you either heat it or cool it, and then you distribute it to the building, and then you recirc a little bit of that with more outdoor air and pass it through some filters, and then you put it back in the building. So the systems are designed so that you can't go crazy with filtration, because what happens is the equipment will start to fail and then you'll have no ventilation. So there are ways to improve it though. So the things that we have suggested to the physical plant people is that you take a look at how much outdoor air you're providing and increase that. And so our physical plant people have been working on that. We've also suggested that they maximize filtration. And this is if you've been reading articles, MERV rating. So the governor really wants MERV 13. The higher the MERV rating, the better the finer the filtration. So we've asked our people to go back and take a look at what sort of filters they're using. And again, this is part of the design of the system. And just make sure that they're using as good as they can. Each time you go up, you stress the system a little bit more, and you get slightly finer filtration. But trying to increase the MERV rating. We're not going to get to HEPA filtration, though. That doesn't really make sense to talk about in most large buildings. We've also asked the physical plant people to keep the systems running for longer. Often they have offsets so that you don't run the ventilation system all night. And we're asking that they perhaps run it for 2 or 3 hours so you can get a couple of air changes for the building on either side of the workday. And we're also asking that they go back and make sure all of their preventative maintenance is up to date and that the systems are acting the way we expect them to. So that's one of the tools that we have. Administrative controls are establishing policies and procedures, training workers on the hazards, and then installing warning labels and similar to keep people aware of the hazards. So this is where we actually can do a lot with COVID. We can do things like talk about social distancing, making people understand why it's important not to gather in little tiny groups or to give grandma a hug or things like that. We can do floor markings like they do in supermarkets, or we can mark 6 feet for the lines. We can tell people and post signage about respiratory etiquette that if I sneeze or cough, I should do so in my arm, in my elbow, or I should do it in a tissue, take the tissue, immediately put it in a trash container and wash my hands. We can talk about hand washing. We can talk about screening employees as they come in. For this part of the talk, I went to the American Industrial Hygiene Association, one of my professional organizations, and they have a couple of documents, talking about reopening. So they specifically have one, guidance for libraries. And it is intended to take a lot of what we know scientifically, as we know it as best we can, and break it down into very readable directions and suggestions. They also have one for museums and collecting institutions, which is a little bit different. They are really great things to just remind you of some of the steps you can take to make your library just a little bit safer. So this is the outline for the guidance for libraries. Again, it's intended for more community libraries, but often a lot of it goes over to an academic library. Cleaning materials. This is a big one. So we're all going to have to start cleaning the things that we touch in high contact places, whether that's the copier or the desk or the doorknobs. We will have custodians. Most custodial staffs are upping their game and cleaning things more frequently. But unfortunately, we're all going to have to pitch in with this as well. So in New York State, you need to use something that has a product that is on a DEC list. And if you read national stuff, they say the EPA's end list. I just look at the DEC list. That's a link to it. You can also, if you go on to New York State Department of Health COVID, you can easily get to that link. And basically, if it's on the DEC list, we know it's on the EPA list. Okay. So you have to look on the container for the instructions. How are you supposed to use the stuff? And then someplace, usually right near the ingredients, it gives you an EPA registry number. So on that container, I was able to find this registry number. And then when I go to the list, it's a, I don't know, 20, 40 page list. And I just search for that EPA registry number and it will tell me that it's on the list, exactly what product it is, make sure that that matches and make sure that it matches what type of product it is. Like this is a wipe. So RTU is ready to use. Sometimes there are sprays, sometimes there are concentrates. So you need to make sure that you're using appropriate cleaners. This is not the time to do the hippie, natural, good vibration cleaners. Okay, you need to make sure that they're going to deal with COVID. So for cleaning and disinfecting, you're going to need to talk to the custodial people to make sure that your needs are being met. You need to identify any high-touch areas and any multi-user equipment. You need to sit down with the custodians and plan for cleaning and disinfection. You need to establish routine procedures and understand how the products that have been selected are to be used. So in my office, I've been here for the duration. I clean each morning when I get in and just before I leave. I presume the custodians clean, but I have like times that I clean. I use my Clorox wipes and I go through and I've identified the surfaces. It takes me not very long at all. But that's the sort of thing that we have to get each person to do. We have to make sure that we have enough cleaning materials available to staff and then probably also to patrons. I know that it's difficult to supply these, but you might want to just put out the Clorox wipes so they can wipe their hands. Wipe the surfaces that they've been on. And then you have to have hand sanitizer. And in the bathrooms, you need to have soap and water ready for cleaning. Distancing is another huge thing that we can do. And in libraries, we really need to take a look at what our common areas are. And we need to make sure what is the maximum occupancy that we can keep people 6 feet apart from one another, and put that up as a sign and make sure that we're using the spaces in accordance with that maximum occupancy. That may mean that in your study room or your conference area, you need to take out loose chairs or you need to tape off areas. You may have a space that you used to have chairs facing each way every 3 or 4 feet down. You might need to take out a whole lot of those chairs. Our occupancy rates are going to go way down. You may want to consider closing or eliminating shared common areas to avoid crowds. You know where in your library people like to hang out, and it might be more appropriate during these days of COVID to take the couch and put it to the side and ask people not to sit there. You may want to consider limiting the capacity or the number of patrons in the library at one time. So my daughter is doing postgraduate work at Durham University in Durham, England, and the school, the university is closed, but they just this week started opening up the library, and for her, and only for postgrads, I think, but she has to sign up and she can have a 2-hour slot. She has to sign up each week. She's assigned a carrel. That is only for that period of time. They clean it up afterwards, and only so many people, there are only so many slots there. And she said it's really eerie being in a library when no one else is there. I think she's exaggerating a little bit, but that's what you're going to need to do. And I know this is difficult for librarians, potentially for libraries, but you may want to limit access. Maybe you can't let anyone who wants to come in, come in. You may have to just limit it to students or limit it to some sort of appointments. Again, I'm not a librarian, but I'm trying to bring up things so hopefully you can discuss it among yourselves, or hopefully I will have triggered a couple of things that you say, well, I can't do this, but I could do this. That's my goal here. So the physical plant people have gone through, this isn't the best graphic, it's the best one I could find, I'm sorry, and they've taken a look at classroom layouts. And they have established new classroom layouts so that each person is 6 feet separated from everyone else. So where they might have had 6 chairs on a table, now maybe they only have 2. So occupancy rates are going way down. Small classrooms are not going to be used because it's just too difficult. And the big, large classrooms are going to be used at a much, much lower capacity. They've also gone through to take a look at like cubby world and the like. And they've talked about how tall does the partitions need to be? How can we make sure that maybe we put arrows on the floor so that there's one directional traffic? So they've been working for the summer on a whole bunch of things like this. This is a draft. I don't really like everything in it, but it's a nice graphic. And from University of Albany, it was a draft. It was early in their process that they were thinking about this. We want to take a look to make sure that we don't end up with lines to either check out materials, come into your facility, use the restroom, whatever. We want to avoid places where people are going to congregate with or without masks. Preferably in New York, everyone has masks. That is a requirement by the governor, and you can actually refuse service to people who won't wear masks. Talk to your campus council about how you're going to do it. For services for libraries, we want to place marks on the floor wherever a line may develop, or just to show people what 6 feet is, because quite frankly, most people don't know. We probably want to have visual reminders about social distancing. We want to make sure that we remove all of the paper brochures and flyers from the common areas, the lobby, the front desk. Don't share pens. Avoid that because you don't want people touching everything, and then you also don't want people congregating to see the latest information. I know that's a change in how we look to libraries, but this is important. We want to avoid those bottlenecks. We want to look to see if there are any services that we can automate, such as checkout to limit contact. We can look at asking patrons to pre-order books or other library materials, and we want to avoid the use of common use of equipment wherever we can. If we can't, we want to make sure we have protocols for cleaning them. For staff distancing, if your desks should be at least 6 feet apart, and you're measuring that from the edge to the edge of the next desk, If possible, some administrative staff might work from home, or you might have a team A and a team B. Again, it depends on what your campus program is. You want to encourage staff not to linger or socialize in common areas or break rooms. I know you want to have a good cohesive team. This is not the time to do it. Take a look at where your staff is meeting with patrons. Maximize the staffing, mark the floor, make it so that it's not easy to pull over a chair and sit real close and discuss the problems. Consider telephone assistance, phone a librarian, Zoom a librarian, as much as possible. For programming, I know that libraries often have readings, performances, gatherings, meetings, tutors. All of these things may be conducted virtually. This may be the time that you can't be all things to all people. You sort of have to make your building a little bit less inviting. Personal protective equipment.
Barbara, there's a good queue of questions. Most of them are focused on cleaning. Do you want to take them now, or are you close?
Okay, I can do the cleaning now. I'm getting closer, but go ahead.
Okay. So the first one was when you were talking about the EPA suggested list. The question was, if there's something that is in that list and there's a generic equivalent, is that okay to use?
No.
Okay,
so the generics, if they're producing it, will have their own EPA registry number. So it could be the same chemicals. The registry number has to be on the list.
And then I'm not sure if you know this off the top of your head, but is wiping surfaces with 60% alcohol okay?
Department of Health has guidance that said it should be 70%.
Excellent. Okay. And then there was a couple of chats about there were reports from a public library that the staff had been using Clorox wipes and they had become ill because of using Clorox wipes. So frequently someone else responded that they were using alcohol-based instead because that was less toxic. Do you have any comments on that?
So I don't know specifically about that event. We are all gonna be using hand sanitizer or surface wipes more frequently, whether they're alcohol or they're the stuff that's in Clorox. They're trying to kill a virus. They're not really good for us. So some people are more susceptible. Some people will end up with dry skin and have to be a little bit more careful. They might have to wear gloves as they're wiping down everything. That actually might just be a good idea in general. We're gonna have to play it by ear. We might have to switch so that you can get to something that is comfortable for you and doesn't cause you problems.
And then there was another question that was about that one campus is having trouble getting things like Clorox wipes, so they're using spray bottles. And then someone else responded that it's not recommended to use spray bottles because the spray aerosolizes the disinfectant and it makes it less, it causes problems with inhaling, et cetera.
Okay, so if you're spraying something that's not intended to be sprayed, yes. Actually, if you're spraying something and inhaling it, yes, it can cause problems. But the important message here is that you need to use the disinfectant in the way it was intended to be used when they asked the EPA for their registration number. So if it is something that is supposed to be used as a wipe, then that's how you should be using it. You can't drain it out and put it in a spray bottle. Similarly, if you have material that is intended to be a spray, you should be spraying it on the surface and letting it stay for the length of time they tell you it needs to do for the EPA registration.
Thanks. And then this one is not related to cleaning, but there was a question that was just asking, are there general guidelines or is there some reference you can point to about partition height? For like a shared office space, like that was in the UAlbany.
There is not clear guidance for that, and so I have had debates with people. If you can keep people 6 feet apart, horizontally rather, that's really important. I don't know if a 5.5 foot divider is good enough if I need to have 6 feet. I think a lot has to do with how people are working, if they're standing up, sitting down. There's not definitive guidance, though. I have looked hard for it.
And the last question before I think we can move on is, is there any SUNY initiative to help with cleaning supplies? Kerry had responded that he was going to look into it, but just checking to see if you had any other comments on that. Kerry Hatch, that is.
Yeah. Right. So I know that our university-wide procurement is looking at establishing contracts and I think has some contracts in place for both PPE and for some cleaning agents. Cleaning agents, they might still be working on it. Hand sanitizer we have been able to get from the New York State Office of Emergency Management for campuses when they've requested it. That's the Department of Corrections material. We can still get that for a while.
All right, great. I think we can move on to PPE.
Okay.
I knew PPE would have some discussion, so I wanted to make sure we got through.
I appreciate that. Again, I don't have a visual feedback. So, okay, so PPE is the last resort of protection simply because it depends on you making the right decision all the time. So one of the things we talk about for COVID is face coverings, which is actually not PPE, it's community protective equipment. And that is where I wear a face cover to protect you from whatever I'm spewing out. New York State now has regulations. Most people are required to wear them unless there's some special situation or you're under two or you have some health issue. The CDC has a number of documents, again, that you can use and put up to remind people. Face coverings can look like surgical masks. They can look like the fabric masks in this picture. They can be gaiters, and they can be balaclavas. I always get that word wrong, and I think I got it right that time. Basically, though, they need to cover the nose and the mouth. Okay, so wearing my mask around my neck is not sufficient. Wearing my mask on my mouth, but not on my nose, is not sufficient. You can refuse service to people who refuse to comply with this. In addition, all of the campus opening plans have some rendition of this or some type of statement about face coverings. But this is a common courtesy. It's sort of a collective responsibility. There are different types of things, of face covers. The N95s are the ones that hospital wearers use. They depend on a really close seal between the mask and the person's face, and there's a whole program for it. We reserve that for healthcare workers. We have a better supply of surgical masks of different qualities, and then people can also use face coverings. The thing that drives me crazy is when I look at face coverings like this lovely N95 made by Moldex. They manufacture in California, lovely company. This is my go-to mask if I need it for home for non-COVID reasons. However, it's got a big exhalation valve. And a lot of the ones that I see when I go to Lowe's or wherever, people are wearing these. What that mask does is it makes sure that when I'm breathing in air, it's clean. It's gone through all the filters. So if the mask fits me correctly, I am protected from other people. But the exhalation valve works so that when I exhale, all my air just comes right out. So it comes right out with any COVID germs or any other germs I have. So this does not keep in the general intent of face coverings. I would not let people into my library wearing something like this. Again, CDC has all sorts of information there. That you can use to post or review. PPE is the other important thing. COVID is not spread through skin contact. However, it can be spread if I touch something that you've just sneezed on and then I touch my face. If you're using gloves, you just want to be careful that it doesn't give you a false sense of security, that when you're removing them, you're not snapping them all over the place. Make sure that you don't start touching your face or your face coverings more because you have the gloves on. People tend to do that. I don't know why. You need to wash your hands or use hand sanitizer when you take your gloves off. You don't want to reduce that or say, God, I was wearing gloves, I can skip that step. And you want to make sure that you dispose of them in the plain old regular trash. It's not medical waste or anything like that. But you need to make sure that they're not just collected on the side of the desk where they can affect other people. So again, these are some of the great banners, the great public service announcements that the CDC has that we can go through. So now, this was my question slide. Did that trigger any questions? Or can I go into library materials really fast? And I know I'm going over a half hour. I'm sorry. Is that okay?
No, it's. I think it's perfectly fine. Okay. There was one question that I'll synthesize a little bit. What I think the intent of the question was is, has there been any discussion about students asking for accommodations that they want to utilize private rooms, because many of our libraries have study rooms. So the term used was if they want to use a study room as a germ bubble. But I think, you know, this type of question could come up of like someone saying, I want to use this room. I need to use this room because
I need the quiet.
Yeah.
So I know that people have taken solace in libraries. Both I wouldn't have gotten through college. I get all of that. You're going to have to come up, though, with a plan on how to address that. You can no longer have these rooms where you have even four or five people in a relatively small room. So I have a conference room down the hall from me that usually has, I don't know, 15 or 16 people in it. And the occupancy now with the 6 feet is four. We also now have to reserve that conference room, and it's reserved for longer than the meeting period so that the custodial people will come in and wipe down all of the surfaces. So yes, you can have these rooms, but you need to maintain the 6 feet, and you need to have some sort of system to make sure that everyone is following the rules and they're clean between users.
Okay. And there was some follow-up discussion too about if there's been a discussion of, you know, so there's social distancing that we want to encourage, but if a group is saying we're dorm mates, we're roommates, we're all going to be in this same room together, and that's going to be our the germ bubble keeps coming up, but
the germ bubble idea. Okay.
I think the group is the key. So I just didn't know if that had come up, because I imagine it's coming up in other predicaments too. Yeah.
So it does come up. And if we look at the New York Forward guidance for higher ed, they talk about the use of face masks and social distancing, unless you are still in the same, I think they call it family unit, and then parenthetically they say that you live in the same room. People are social animals. That's going to be tough. But that is the guidance from New York State, that you don't let down your guard unless that's the person you're living with, and then you become like a little social bubble. That other bubbles are going to exist. It decreases safety. It doesn't surprise me, but it's not as safe. Should I continue?
I think there's one last one that I think would be good to talk about, and it's about the masks with respirator valves. So the question was, if a mask has a respirator valve and is not an N95, we should not use it, correct? But I think what you were saying is respirator valves typically mean that exhaling is not filtered, inhaling is filtered.
Yep,
typically.
That's what it is. So any type of mask that has those exhalation valves, which make them more comfortable, are not protecting other people. Okay?
I think we're caught up. Thank you.
Okay. So I think many of you are familiar with the Realm Project, which is a multi library museum, Battelle National Lab, and they're taking a look at library materials to help you determine how long you have to quarantine things coming into libraries and what sort of precautions you need to take. So it's a big project. Phase one, which is ending this month, was a literature review. They developed testing plans so that Battelle could test how long the germ lives on different library type materials. They did some initial testing. They started one actually even just last week. They're gathering information on protocols and whatnot. Whoops. Oh, I went all the way to the end. Close your eyes. Okay, phase two, they're going to test more materials. They're going to look at workflows in libraries and do some additional testing. Phase three is going to be a watch and wait from October to September of next year. They're going to monitor what's going on in the libraries and figure out what other information librarians and library managers need. So the first set of testing was published in July, I think. And they took a look at how long the virus lives on these sorts of surfaces. And basically what they did is they took little pieces of those materials that were donated from libraries. They were not disinfected or anything beforehand, just as they were, things that were in circulation. They took little samples of them, they put the virus on them, and then they watched what happened to the virus when these little pieces of material, little coupons, were laying out on trays at library-like temperature and humidities. So it sort of looked like the picture on the right. And they wanted to take a look at what happened to the COVID virus at not 6, 9, and 12 days. And then they realized that it attenuated very quickly. So they did a second round. And then they looked at what happens to the virus at days 1, 3, and 4. Okay, so those are the colored lines are the different materials. This is a logarithmic scale. So each one of these is a factor of 10. So 1 is 10, 2 is 100, 3 is 1,000. This line over here, can you see my, okay, the red dashed line is the limit of quantification. And that is that they can count sort of how many of the viruses are still alive and able to infect at a certain point in time. This, of course, is the time frame. And so below this line, it's a very qualitative answer. Yeah, they see some living viruses, or no, they can't find any. But this is quantitative. So they looked at the decay of the materials, and their conclusion was by day 3, pretty much all of the materials they tested didn't have the virus left. And this is what supports a 72-hour quarantine. So that's what you've heard about. Part two is a stack configuration, because people came back and said, ooh, we don't put out all of our materials like on little trays and just leave them open to the air. We actually stack them. And this experiment then looked at these materials the way you would find them in a library. In this case, they took the small little materials and stuck them inside books or stuck them inside folders and then took a look at what happened. And this is the same sort of scale. Again, it's logarithmic. This is the time. This is my quantification level. And they saw that it took a little bit longer than 3 days to see the materials go to a place where they were non-detectable as viable. By the second day, certainly by the third day, they were so low that you couldn't measure them. We don't know if a single virus could cause disease. So you could argue that your 72-hour quarantine could be 4 days. It's just not really likely because this is pretty low. Again, each of these increases is a factor of 10. Okay, so they are now 4 days was the most that it took for anything to go down. So, and that was their final time point. And that's to go down to zero. They are going to soon publish tests on other types of materials that you generally see in libraries. They're also going through, and they just started a test last Friday, I think, for the materials that they studied in the very first test, but this time in a stacked configuration. And again, their whole point here is not to develop recommendations, but to provide you with information about how long your quarantine period should be. So 3 days, maybe 4 days. There's some studies that were really early that talked about 7 days. You could choose to do that, probably way overkill, but for something very strange or you want to be extra, extra careful, you could do that. But typically I think museums and libraries are using the 72 hours or the 96 hours. So I think you were all familiar with that. So I tried to keep that short and sweet. Good so far with questions?
There was only one follow-up question, which was on masks. And I think the question was that, you know, that there someone had seen a mask with a respirator valve, but then it had a filter. And then just, you know, I think there may be students who are coming with different types of masks. And just, you know, your comment on, are there any good masks with respirator valves that also have filters if someone wants to, you know, do that type of?
No, the whole purpose of the valve is to let your air out easily. So once you see the valve, you know that it's not acting as a filter for things coming out. I would make that a hard and fast rule. I don't know if it's in all the campus reopening plans though. I know that several campuses have put that in their plans.
Excellent. Thank you.
Okay. So when I was preparing for this, I also looked at the Northeast Document Conservation Center. They have information out there about conservation and also what to do in case of COVID. They suggest a minimum 3-day quarantine. And again, if you wanted to go longer, maybe 4 days, maybe a week, you could decide to do that, but probably 3 days is sufficient. Again, we don't have everything etched in stone, so we're doing the best we can. The Realm Project will bring a higher level of confidence to these decisions. They talk about disinfecting, and I've had a couple of questions from campuses where people want to disinfect things in all sorts of unusual ways. So they came out actually though and said liquid disinfectants and powder cleaners on things like books don't make sense. You don't want to use them. You don't want wet, soggy books, even if they smell like Lysol. UV ray exposure as a means of sterilization is not recommended in most general cases. There may be very specific circumstances where something like that would work. We know that UVC does kill the COVID virus. However, it needs to be in contact with that light, and the light has to have sufficient intensity. And when you have those factors in place, not only does it kill the COVID, but it also hurts other materials. And you have to make sure that no one is exposed to it, because UVC is even worse on the scale from wrinkles to skin cancer. UVC is worse. It kills stuff. It kills the virus. Probably not, doesn't make sense to use on your typical books, typical magazines, typical library materials. Microwave ovens, big no-no. Yes, the microwave may kill the virus, but it's much more likely to cause a fire. Fogging of disinfectants is generally not considered to be useful for most collections. Again, there may be very limited uses. Everyone came out of the woodwork back in May and June trying to sell us fogging, disinfecting systems, where people had envisioned that you just walk through the building with a little wand and everything would be fogged. That fog has to get to the place where the germs are. So if the virus is in a book on a shelf, fogging it probably isn't going to get to it. So it has limited value. Again, they're looking at this and they'll update their recommendation as time comes by. So again, more from the CDC. They really have lots of stuff. You can go to print resources to get all sorts of posters, 8.5 by 11, 11 by 17. You can feel free to use it in your newsletters, communications, whatever. This is something from the Texas Medical Association, and they have quantified, or semi-quantitatively, I guess, they've taken a look at different activities that we all want to go back to, and sort of try to make them separate into low risk, moderate risk, and high risk. Again, it's the Texas Medical Association. They were kind enough to say that we could use their stuff as long as we provided credit. So that is something that might be of interest to you. But basically, keep calm and wash your hands. And I know that that is much easier to say than do in times of COVID. So at lunchtime today, when I was nervous that I had to give this presentation, I read the New York Times at lunchtime. And they actually have in today's paper 5-minute coronavirus stress resets, 5 somewhat bizarre things to do so that you can just break the stress and like stop that spiral of, oh my God, this is never going to end. We're all going to die. It is interesting reading. I do some of them. One of them though is to immerse your face in ice. And supposedly it stops this spiral of loss of control for just a short period of time. I think it's 10 seconds. But there are some less drastic measures as well. So that's in today's times. So one of them is also listening to music, hopefully uplifting, calming music. You can try that. Sometimes I just feel though I need to just like crawl into the belly of something. So that is my contact information. I am available if I can help you. The environmental health and safety person on your campus has probably been working very hard over these past couple of months. Please find out who that person is if you don't know who they are. They can provide you with guidance as well. I work with them a lot. There's a collection of really great people. The emergency managers have been working, and also the physical plant directors.
So Barbara, we tried to give you a few questions we knew you would be asked, and I'm remiss in sharing this one with you, but someone brought this up. A lot of our libraries have anatomy sets, so bones and skulls, etc., that they allow people to use and circulate. Do you have any recommendations for cleaning those or anything like that?
So I don't off the top of my head, and this is a problem because my daughter who's studying in England is a bioarchaeologist. So I should know, and I don't. I would, however, suggest that, well, they can reach out to me, but the American Industrial Hygiene Association has that whole reopening guide. I don't know for a fact that information is there, but I'm thinking it might be.
Okay, great. I think we're caught up on questions.
I gave you things to think about. So hopefully I know that you all have your reopening plans, your personal reopening plans, but hopefully I've jogged your thought process just a little bit over this past 50 minutes. I appreciate you all listening. Hope you found it useful.
Barbara, thank you so much. This has been great.
Yes. Yeah.
Thank you very much. I will leave then, but feel free to give me a call or reach out to me by email if I can help in any way.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Shannon, you have recorded this and it will